Welcome to Drop Market Spaces today to talk money. Just as a reminder before we begin, this material is presented solely for informational and entertainment purposes only, and is not to be construed as a recommendation, solicitation, or an offer to buy or sell, long or short, any securities, commodities, or related financial instruments. Please contact a licensed professional before making any investment or trading decisions. And with that, right, both of our guests probably do not need any introductions, but first we have Lynn Alden. Lynn's background lies in the intersection of engineering and finance. She has a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and a master's in engineering management with a focus on engineering economics and financial modeling. She's been performing investment research for over 15 years after retiring from an engineering in various public and private capacities, and she founded Lynn Alden Investment Strategy in 2016. Her goal is to provide institutional-level research in plain English so that both institutional investors and retail investors can benefit from it. Her work has been editorially featured or cited on a media of plethora of media channels, and she just published her first book last year, which is called Broken Money, which is a bestseller on Amazon. Next, we have Marty Bent, who is a managing partner at 1031. 1031 is a leading Bitcoin-focused investor and partner of choice to companies building technology and infrastructure for the Bitcoin ecosystem, as well as complementary freedom-oriented technologies, including open-source software, AI, and Nostr. He's also the founder of TFTC. It's a super popular podcast dedicated to bringing you content that spans the realm of Bitcoin economics, privacy, freedom, technology, and culture, which I have had the pleasure of being on guest on more than once. He's also the director of Cathedra. I hope I pronounced that right, which is a company that has diversified Bitcoin mining operations across 3 states and 5 locations in the U.S. And previously, he was the director of business development at Great American Mining, a Bitcoin mining company focused on off-grid deployments using non-rival energy sources such as natural gas that otherwise would be flared throughout oil fields. And with that, thank you both for coming today and really appreciate your time. I just want to hit on, I'm going to start with Lynn. How we do this is in a round. Marty, you haven't been a guest here before, but so we do this in a round. And, you know, feel free to comment on each other's comments. If you would like, we can make this as round table as you would like. Just want to start with Lynn. I just want to hit on CPI really quick because it just came out today. I don't want to spend too much time on this. First, you know, they're telling us the economy is great, everything's great, and, you know, unemployment rate is still low if you actually believe the BLS numbers, and yet they're talking rate cuts. Now we've seen the 5th month in a row we had CPI come in hot. One is the Fed going to have to accept over 2%, or do you think the Fed is politically pressured in any way to cut rates this year, being that we've seen this sudden change of tone talking about rates, rate cuts?
Yeah, it's a good set of questions. I've been describing this as a period of fiscal dominance, meaning that because public debts are very high and a large portion of kind of the new credit creation and new money creation is from the fiscal side rather than from bank lending or bond issuance, that Fed policy overall, especially the interest rate portion, is not as effective at quelling inflation compared to if we were in an environment more like the 70s where most of the money creation is coming from that private sector bank lending and corporate bond issuance side. And so I think it's fundamentally an issue of kind of the wrong tools for the job. But because those are really the only tools they have available and they have a mandate, they kind of have to use the tools they have, even if sometimes they backfire. So I think basically what we're probably going to see is a Fed that's fairly neutral this year. They made the mistake of waiting too long. At least optically, they waited too long when inflation was getting hot. They were slow to acknowledge it, slow to act. But once they acted, they were very quick. I think they're cautious around overshooting to the other side. They don't want to get super hawkish and then kind of, you know, put the economy into like a recession, kind of like squarely doing so. So I think that they're kind of playing that middle ground. I also think that they're increasingly realizing the fiscal dominance issue and that their rate changes are not necessarily the key factor to rein inflation in. It's really about the fiscal side that determines a lot of what's happening with inflation, as well as things like energy supply demand dynamics. And both of those things are largely outside of the Fed purview. The Fed purview, most of their tools are around, you know, either encouraging bank lending to accelerate and overall kind of credit issuance to accelerate, or trying to de-incentivize that. And the challenge is if that's not the core, if that's not as big of a factor as fiscal, which is what's happening now, and it's a fairly rare situation where that's true, then their tools are just not the main tools to address it. And I think that they're increasingly realizing that. So, yeah, my base case is a fairly neutral Fed, and then inflation that on average is going to be over 2%, you know, for large portions of this decade. You know, we could touch 2% for periods of time, but I think that the average this decade is going to be notably higher than the last decade.
Excellent. Thank you. And then I want to move on to our topic at hand. You wrote a piece back in January called Assessing the Health of Bitcoin. And within that article, you addressed the issue of how convertible a type of money is using fiat, gold, and Bitcoin. And can you talk a little bit about this? And then, you know, George Gammon basically tried to repeat this experiment that you gave in this article, and he kind of had a problem. So what are your thoughts on that?
So I think overall, Bitcoin's still in the early phases. So far, it's 15 years in, but really only the past 5 years have been liquid on kind of a macro scale. You know, kind of the first 10 years is like a science experiment. The latest 5 years is kind of the more of the like early adopter period. And so it's going through a lot of development. You know, both Marty and I are you know, do some work in the obviously the Bitcoin venture space. And so we kind of deal with a lot of companies that are trying to improve that over time. In the Bitcoin Health article, one thing I focus on is trying to figure out which of the many metrics that Bitcoin has are worth focusing on when determining its overall health. And so, for example, market price and liquidity are an important variable, but they're not the only variable. And there's other issues like convertibility and overall kind of measures of decentralization, measures of security, like how many instances there have been, for example. And by most metrics overall, I consider it to be pretty healthy. I think the two areas of real improvement to make are there's some work to be done, I think, on the mining decentralization front. Both the supply chain side as well as the pool and kind of the overall incentive side. And the second area would be kind of overall user UX, which is basically what George ran into, what some of the merchants run into. And those, you know, the solutions to those come from two different avenues. I think they're moving in the right direction, but, you know, it's still fairly early. If you kind of measure the internet, you know, kind of in the pre-browser phase, or even early after the introduction of the browser, it still would have been a experience that's more so for power users and less so for mass market. And I think the next era of just overall Bitcoin development is trying to bring it more to that mass market.
Excellent. Thank you. And then moving on to Marty. Marty, first, I wanted to get your opinion on these new Bitcoin ETFs and the incredible inflows that we have seen. First, are you a fan of these? Have they made Bitcoin more accessible? What does that mean for Bitcoin in general? You know, if you own this ETF, you're not actually owning Bitcoin yourself, meaning you can't cash out of it for actual Bitcoin. So what are your thoughts on this?
Tracy, thanks for having me. And I mean, on the ETFs generally, I mean, they've obviously given people access to Bitcoin. I actually think Lynn had an incredible analogy on a podcast a few weeks ago, basically describing the ETFs as API infrastructure into the Bitcoin economy for the traditional financial system. I think that's a great analogy where I don't think there's anything we can do about BlackRock and others deciding to spin up an ETF. Bitcoin is a permissionless system that anybody can access, and it's an asset that anybody can leverage. And so whether you agree or disagree that people should get Bitcoin exposure via an ETF is really something that you can't control. The reality is they exist, and they have been driving significant flows to Bitcoin. One of the things I would highlight that is a bit concerning is that a lot of these ETFs custody their Bitcoin with one custodian, which I think provides potential risk from like something like an executive order 6102 attack down the line. I do think there are ways to mitigate that risk that the ETF issuers should be thinking of, whether that's diversifying who they custody their Bitcoin with, or holding their Bitcoin in a multi-institution, multi-sig model, which I think is superior to having centralized risk with Coinbase alone. But yeah, the ETFs, they're here. As a Bitcoiner who believes that you should hold your own private keys, it's not how I would get exposure to Bitcoin, but there's, again, nothing that I personally can do about it, or anybody else can do about it for that matter. And I do think in terms of awareness and legitimization of Bitcoin in the eyes of institutional capital, there's certainly a net benefit. But I think in the long run, holding your Bitcoin or getting exposure to Bitcoin via an ETF is something that is not going to turn out to be too wise, because I do think to leverage the inherent fundamental value of the peer-to-peer network and the layers being built on top of it, you're going to have direct Bitcoin exposure at some layer of that stack, whether that's owning Bitcoin directly at the protocol level or owning Bitcoin via second layer solutions like Lightning or Fedimints. There's utility that comes with actually using Bitcoin. You're not going to be able to leverage that utility via shares of an ETF.
And what are your thoughts on, you know, regulation? Obviously, is a very hot topic in the cryptocurrency and Bitcoin space. So, you know, how do you think regulatory developments will shape the future of Bitcoin, both United States and globally? And, you know, can governments really get that involved?
I mean, like, certainly try to get as involved as they want to, and they have historically. I think I have a lot of thoughts on this particular topic. I would just say, broadly speaking, I think the United States, particularly speaking as an American, the wise decision for the U.S. would be to let Bitcoin proliferate, let Americans use Bitcoin. I think they should get rid of the capital gains tax, and they should let the industry continue to develop within the United States. We have a massive lead in terms of the mind share that is here building companies, whether that's on the software side or the physical infrastructure side in the mining sector. I think what's going on between Bitcoin mining industry and the energy sector is extremely fascinating, important, and something that most people don't understand. I think it's a really profound intersection that's beginning to materialize. I think Bitcoin really supercharges the energy sector and allows energy producers, whether that's upstream oil and gas producers, power generation companies, utilities companies, to really increase their revenues and allow them to reinvest in their infrastructure. I think that should be allowed to proliferate. We've seen governments try to step in and ban Bitcoin in the past, most notably with China in 2021 with the Bitcoin mining ban. That has proven to be somewhat ineffective. I believe 20% of network hash rate is still within China's borders, and it's very well known that Chinese nationals are still accessing Bitcoin with ease. And so I do think governments will try to step in and regulate and prevent Bitcoin from proliferating as it should be allowed to. But I think in the long run, that'll be wholly ineffective since Bitcoin is this distributed system that's available globally if a government tries to prevent it in one part of the world, another government in another part of the world will see that as an opportunity and lean into it and develop a lot of mind share. We're seeing that happen in El Salvador right now. It's a small country, but I think what they're doing, I think they're punching way above their weight class due to how they've approached Bitcoin specifically. And then another sort of subtopic of this is I do think we've already begun to see this materialize, and I think it will only accelerate moving forward, which is this this jurisdictional arbitrage at the state level in the United States. So I think post-COVID, a lot of individual states are asserting their autonomy from the federal government and crafting policy in particular ways. And we've seen some states craft particular Bitcoin policy. And I think if the federal government were to step in and try to prevent something like Bitcoin mining or the right for individuals to possess Bitcoin and hold their own private keys and transact in Bitcoin, states would step up and protect their citizens. And so, yeah, the regulatory landscape is probably one of the biggest questions in the room right now. What's going to happen moving forward? I think the United States has an incredible opportunity, and I don't think we should blow that opportunity. We're doing incredibly well right now. If they were to try to blow it, I think it would be ineffective in the long run. It would only hurt individual Americans and not Bitcoin itself. And then on top of that, I could see a scenario where if the federal government does try to prevent Bitcoin, the states would step up. Some states would step up and try to protect their citizens and their right to access and use Bitcoin in the way they see fit.
I think from a regulatory perspective, we're probably going to see different aspects for different parts. So for example, the store of value aspect, regulators seem to really be relenting on. So for example, the introduction of the ETFs, even in China, Hong Kong, there's headlines around potential ETFs. Basically from a government perspective, if they can have fairly walled garden Bitcoin adoption, they're seemingly fine with that. I think the battlegrounds are going to be more around payments and privacy. And so payments can be somewhat restricted by capital gains taxes, which is in place now, and kind of enforcement of those taxes. And the privacy aspect, generally that's where they go pretty harsh with things like even like prison sentences on people who try to build or operate privacy solutions. Even, some of the people that do those things get bigger prison sentences than if you lose billions of dollars in customer funds. Kind of shows where their priorities are. And so I think that, and they can't stamp out payments or privacy entirely, but what they can do is add frictions to them, which limits their liquidity. They basically can make it harder to access on a mass scale, and therefore they can slow it down. They can add all sorts of frictions. As Marty mentioned, there is jurisdictional arbitrage. So if some jurisdictions are cracking down on that and a handful of others are opening up to that, that's kind of where the battleground is, because, there's 200 countries to kind of deal with this on. And many of the countries have some degree of rule of law, meaning that if one part of the government wants to go after something, there's a court system that can push back on it. This happened in India. This happened in the United States with the ETFs. And so I think that'll be a recurring theme in some countries. But basically, I think that's we've kind of, I think, gotten past the store of value part. I think the market and the regulators are working through the energy component. That's still somewhat of a battleground, but I think that's shifting. And I think in the future, it's really the payments and especially private payments, or just privacy in general. I think that's where a lot of the regulatory frictions are going to be focused.
And Lynn, I kind of wanted your opinion, kind of moving over to taking all three assets, Bitcoin, gold, and USD all together. For a while there, everybody, we had Novid in gold and Bitcoin doing really well. And the big narrative, or at least the narrative on Twitter, was, nobody wants gold anymore. All the money, that went into gold is now going into Bitcoin. But now what we're seeing is an elevated gold and Bitcoin at the same time, as well as USD. So, can you talk about this a little bit, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, so even as a Bitcoin bull, I've not been bearish gold. And I am the camp that I think both are going to rise this decade. You know, ever since the U.S. left the, you know, any sort of gold peg, after a big devaluation, they started from a position of low public debt to GDP, low private debt to GDP, high real rates. And so they had several decades of runway to kind of draw down that starting point, that capital base. And so after decades of debt accumulation, decades of trade deficit accumulation, basically the world was becoming more and more unipolar during that period. You know, there was the breakdown of the Soviet Union, there was the opening of China to the rest of the world. This was a lot of, and a lot of global capital was therefore flocking toward treasuries and flocking away from gold. So if you look at, for example, central bank tonnage of gold, it was declining for decades, and it bottomed in 2009. So the global financial crisis kind of marked the turning point in that kind of structural trend, is how I see it. And so for the past 15 years or so, there's been this period of central banks have been increasing their tonnage of gold. They've not been investing as heavily into treasuries. You know, there's no like wholesale sale of treasuries, but they're just not really accumulating them as fast as they're being issued. And therefore, the percentage of treasuries owned by the foreign market has been declining for quite some time. That's partially because of the strong dollar environment. So reserves are not going up as fast as they were before. But even as a percentage of reserves, gold is making a comeback. It's still, you know, roughly 10 times the size of the Bitcoin market. It's still, you know, large. It's large enough for sovereigns. Sovereigns, except for smaller ones, like, for example, El Salvador or the Kingdom of Bhutan, they're not exactly super fast pivoters. And so I think that gold's still going to play a significant part going forward in a world that becomes more multipolar, in a world where public debts, especially of the United States, become more relevant, and where, you know, having assets that can't be frozen by your enemies or your frenemies nationally is a key attribute. And so I kind of view it in that sense that gold is going to be, you know, partially retail driven, but probably mainly central bank driven, whereas Bitcoin is probably kind of a combination of all of those. And so I'm in the camp that kind of sees them all going up.
And, you know, what are your thoughts on why just now gold is finally breaking out? I mean, there's a lot of narratives running around right now about that. It's, you know, a hedge against inflation suddenly again, that correlation is back, or it's soaring debt levels, not in the US, but globally, or it's all China central bank buying. So why do you think that suddenly, you know, it's just starting to wake up?
So gold has been breaking out in multiple currencies for a while. The dollar was one of the last ones for it to break out in. It's been in this like 3-year consolidation. So, you know, if anything, I expected to break out maybe a year ago. The fact that it's taken so long has been somewhat surprising. I think that once it broke out, it was kind of like holding a beach ball underwater. Like, it had room to run once it broke out. So I think some of it is technical momentum based. I think other parts of it have to do with the more widespread acknowledgement of a fiscal problem. And so if say there's inflation and markets expect that therefore the Fed's gonna be hawkish, and that they're gonna get inflation under control through their hawkishness, then they're probably not gonna expect gold to do very well because they're expecting more of a strong dollar, positive real rates. On the other hand, if they start to see inflation and they start to lose the view that the Fed is able to control inflation effectively due to things I mentioned before, for example, the fact that fiscal deficits are a bigger driver of inflation than bank credit, for example, and the Fed's tools are primarily aimed at regulating the size and the speed of changes in bank credit, then the market starts to say, well, if there's inflation and they're not really clearly in control of it, then maybe I want to own gold. And of course, you can add geopolitical issues. The more multipolar world, you know, obviously in the past several months, there's been acceleration in some of these geopolitical issues. And so I kind of view multiple of those factors together in the sense of why now. You know, but this could have happened 6 months ago. Why is it happening right now? I mean, markets sometimes do that where they kind of, they delay for a while, then a lot of things happen at once, just because there's algorithms, there's momentum chasers. But I think this breakout, if anything, is overdue.
Excellent. Thank you. Moving back to Marty, I want to talk a little bit about energy and Bitcoin mining. We've talked about this before, but obviously there's environmental concerns surrounding Bitcoin mining. But, you know, we've just seen Argentina has a new initiative to power Bitcoin mining with natural gas that they just announced last fall. I know you've been involved in such projects before. Can you kind of go into detail? I know you touched on it, but can you kind of go into detail a little bit more what this entails? What does this mean for Bitcoin, and why are not more countries doing this?
Yeah, I touched on it earlier that the intersection of Bitcoin mining and the energy sector is profound. It's happening on many levels. There's a lot of misconceptions around whether or not Bitcoin is good for the environment, and whether or not we should be using as much energy to power these Bitcoin mines. And it is true, Bitcoin mining does use a lot of energy, and I think we'll use significantly more in the future. And this is a good thing because the economic incentives of a Bitcoin miner are such that they're highly incentivized to find the lowest cost power possible. And it just so happens that lowest cost power is found at places where energy is either stranded or wasted. And so there's many different types of Bitcoin mining at many different scales. And so we'll just start on the furthest, at the furthest edge, which I would argue is off-grid mining with stranded natural gas. And so you can do that in two ways, whether that's gas that otherwise be flared or vented because it doesn't have a way to get into a pipeline to get the midstream to be processed. So this is literally stranded in a remote location. And so Bitcoin miners are location agnostic. They can monetize energy on site. And so there's no such thing as stranded energy more in a world in which Bitcoin mining proliferates. And so on off-grid, the miners come, they bring generators, they produce electricity, they plug in their computers, and they mine Bitcoin off-grid. That's an added benefit where you can be extremely efficient with the associated gas that comes out of oil and gas wells, particularly that gas that can't get to market. And in the U.S., I mean, just personally, for the miners that I run to mine for myself, for my personal account, they're located on stranded wells that have been shut in Appalachia. And these are wells that were, they were drilled with associated oil. They were relatively shallow oil basins. They never built natural gas pipelines or midstream infrastructure to actually process the gas. All they cared about was getting the oil out of the ground and getting it to market. They didn't really care about the gas. And what this has left behind is a massive stranded natural gas well problem. Tens of thousands of these wells throughout Appalachia, hundreds of thousands throughout the U.S. And these wells are just sitting there capped in rural parts of the country, and they're not being maintained well. And that leads to potential methane leak as the wells deprecate because they're not being maintained. So Bitcoin mining, being driven by pure economic incentives, provides a free market solution to actually maintain these wells. So for my personal miners, we showed up, we found a stranded gas well that wasn't being maintained. We went to the landowner, said, hey, we'll pay your land lease for the year if you'll let us get access to your gas. And so the product of that is we show up, we maintain the well because we're incentivized to do so, so that we have reliable power to mine Bitcoin, and we prevent that methane from being leaked, and we monetize that gas that was stranded previously. So we're getting economic value out of something that was previously seen as a lost cause. So that's on the furthest edge. And then when you move in to on-grid mining, there's incredible efficiencies that happen there as well. And so I live in Austin, Texas right now. We're seeing a lot of mining proliferate, particularly in West Texas. And Bitcoin miners are being used as large flexible load to participate in demand response, to ensure that residential consumers have electricity during times of peak demand, when it's hottest in the summer and coldest in the winter. And so Bitcoin miners are able to come in and give power producers assurances in terms of how much capacity they can build out to deliver to market. Typically, the way these grids work is they build out capacity, thinking with peak demand in mind. And outside of times of peak demand, that capacity typically isn't being utilized until Bitcoin mining came to market. And so during these periods of off-peak demand, Bitcoin miners can soak up that excess capacity and provide the power generators and the utility companies significant revenue streams. And then when peak demand comes, and the grid needs more electricity for residential consumers to turn on their heat or turn on their air conditioners, the Bitcoin miners are uniquely suited to respond to those demand signals immediately within seconds. 15 seconds, I think, you can turn down tens of megawatts of mining capacity and deliver that electricity back to market. And so that's creating grid stability. And then on top of that, on grid as well, what we're finding, particularly in West Texas, is that it's helping these previously defunct renewable energy projects that have run out of renewable energy credits. It's helping those to actually be profitable on the back end of their life cycle when they're not able to take the subsidies from the federal government. And so there's a great example of that in Cormint, which is in West Texas. They essentially went and acquired a substation and a wind farm that was completely shut down because it had run out of the ability to take renewable energy credits. They acquired those assets in an equity deal. The previous owner of the wind farm basically transferred the wind farm and the substation into Cormint as an equity injection in their company. And Bitcoin, you put a Bitcoin mine on that wind farm, and because of all the renewable energy that's been built out in West Texas, you have a lot of times where there's negative pricing. There's so much electricity being produced, the prices go negative. And Bitcoin mining provides an incredible mechanism to basically eliminate those negative pricing events. And so instead of basically giving that electricity to the grid at negative prices, you instead divert that electricity to mine Bitcoin to actually produce positive revenue. So those are examples like going from the edge to on-grid. And there's other benefits on-grid as well. I'm involved with Cathedra that you mentioned earlier. We're in the process of merging with a company called Kungsleden Inc. And what Kungsleden does is it goes, it's an on-grid play, but it's smaller scale. Basically, it's again, an arbitrage play where we go to rural areas throughout the country to find substations that aren't utilizing their full capacity anymore because large manufacturing facilities have moved out of the country due to globalization over the last few decades. So you had these substations that were built with these large manufacturing facilities in mind. And so you built a 20 megawatt substation, you're going to send 15 megawatts to that facility. And that was going to be your demand source into perpetuity. At least that's what people thought. Due to globalization, that factory had to shut down and move overseas. And that substation sitting there only being utilized 75% or 25, only have 25% utilization. And so what Bitcoin miners can do is go to these utilities companies that own these substations, say, hey, you can buy more power in bulk from your power provider. And we will soak up the rest of the capacity on your substation. And that leads to these utilities being able to buy power at lower rates and then being able to pass those lower rates on to residential consumers. And I think the long-winded answer I just went on highlights the profundity of integrating Bitcoin mining in the energy sector. It is the largest free market solution to the problems that exist both off-grid and on-grid, whether it's utilizing wasted or stranded natural gas, creating grid stability, or helping to revitalize areas in the Rust Belt that have suffered severely due to globalization. And this can be applied anywhere in the world. So Argentina has woken up to this and understands that you can utilize your previously wasted energy assets to actually monetize them and support your energy system. And Argentina is not the only country to do this. Bhutan has announced in the last year and a half that they've been mining Bitcoin with their excess capacity in their hydroelectric facilities. And I think they just announced recently that they're expanding their operations pretty significantly. Oman has invested directly in a Bitcoin miner within their country to utilize their wasted energy sources. And I think this is a theme that's only going to accelerate from here. And it's a massively beneficial thing, not only for energy systems, but for humanity. It strengthens our energy systems and allows us to have more reliable energy and to monetize every molecule that we possibly can.
And then we had a question from the audience. And so I don't quite understand her question. So I'm going to go ahead and let her ask it. Go ahead, Christine.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So clearly, you know, we're hearing a lot of claims about how Bitcoin is beneficial in terms of preventing flared gas or reducing flared gas. And then you've also made claims about how it's strengthening the grid. But where can we go to actually quantify the actual benefits that's been seen to date? Right now in West Texas, we're in a situation of negative pricing. Negative pricing was happening for the majority of March. So unless Bitcoin miners in Texas can prove with tickets that they have been being paid to take that natural gas away, then this is like a real world, real time situation where tickets should be being able to be produced. And you can say, hey, you know, we took this volume and we prevented that volume from either being flared or shut in. And it's most likely not being flared because the new, emissions regulations really prevents flaring, as well as the methane sat that's currently circling the globe. That's also going to be finding need to be shut down. And then also the claim that you've revitalized these areas, you know, where they had gas wells. I mean, really, that like that's a benefit to you because you've been able to go in and buy low cost leases and you've been able to produce power for less than what you would have been able to buy that power. So, I mean, like, that's good for your, you know, for the Bitcoin miners for having that kind of foresight. But you're not the only one that's doing that. I mean, Elon Musk even bought a percentage in a natural gas field because he knew that Tesla's demands here in Texas were going to be really
strong. Do we have a question?
And okay. Yeah. The question is, where can we go find the information? Like,
yeah. So in terms of what's happening here in Texas, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of flare gas mitigation happening here in Texas, just due to the environment. It's too hot to air cool these units. I think it will come more to Texas as hydro cooled units become more popular and it becomes easier to actually maintain your machines in the Texas heat. But in terms of direct data within Texas, I mean, ERCOT provides that data on a daily basis. So if you look at the large flexible load reaction to demand and pricing signals on a daily basis, Bitcoin miners make up more than 95% of the large flexible load within ERCOT. And so you can see, I believe during the winter storm earlier this year, there was a really good chart floating around. I couldn't find it. I just tried to find it. I know Pierre Richard from Riot Platform tweeted it out. But you can see as the prices and demand for electricity spiked, the large flexible load turned down almost immediately. And that led to obviously grid stability because the grid didn't go down. That's the evidence there. And then you can see it. So the evidence really lies in the pricing. That is reacting to supply being delivered to market as these miners turn down within ERCOT. And then in terms of the negative pricing data, I mean, you'd have to go to the individual miners. I think Cormint has been pretty transparent about their operations and how they're basically helping to monetize this wind farm despite negative pricing that exists throughout ERCOT. So the data's out there, and ERCOT's providing it. They're not saying specifically Bitcoin miners are doing this. The Bitcoin miners fall under the large flexible load operators, and they make up 95% of large flexible load within ERCOT. And so they're driving a lot of that. And then in terms of the revital, I mean, in the stranded natural gas well situation, I mean, it's it's evident. There's no Bitcoin mining due to the fact that it's geographic, it's agnostic geographically. You can monetize it on site. There's nothing else that can really do that, particularly at the small scale of these stranded natural gas wells. They provide like 21 MCFD, and so that's a very small amount of gas that doesn't make sense for any other economic activity outside of Bitcoin mining. And so it's really just common sense in that use case where the well would sit there and be unmaintained. But due to the fact that the Bitcoin miners want the energy to mine cheaply, like they're highly incentivized to keep that maintained so they can remain profitable. It's a pure market incentive.
All right.
I'll add something real quick. We've also seen the rotation of Bitcoin miners to wherever they're stranded energy. So when people conceptualize Bitcoin mining, they often assume that all energy that's produced is consumed and that therefore any other consumer of energy is basically competing in a zero-sum game with other consumers. Whereas what we see in reality is that a very large percentage of energy that is produced is wasted. It's curtailed, it's leaked, it's otherwise not used. And basically the unique aspect of Bitcoin mining is how flexible it is. It can go in, it doesn't need a lot of bandwidth, so it can go in remote locations. It can shut down almost instantly you can't shut down a hospital, for example. You can't shut down a steel mill quickly. These have economic downsides when you do that, but you can shut down Bitcoin mining very quickly. And so that flexibility is what allows them to go to places. And so, for example, it's not a surprise that we see Bitcoin mining cluster around overbuilt hydro or, many small shale wells or isolated electrical grids like Texas. So back when China was the largest Bitcoin miner, the way that it generally worked there is that during the rainy season, China had overbuilt a lot of hydro in parts of their country. And so during the rainy season, there was just an abundance of electricity that was not used, and Bitcoin miners would flock there. And then during the dry season, they'd rotate elsewhere in the country. And now that, China's kind of partially clamped down on Bitcoin mining, it's kind of shifted over to the United States. It's not surprising that they're clustering around Texas, which has their unique grid setup. And it's not an accident that they're kind of clustering around the fact that the United States and Canada have a large number of smaller wells with a lot of stranded gas that is either vented or flared otherwise, and therefore can be used in Bitcoin mining. And so it kind of goes around the world filling in these gaps that most other sources of energy demand can't really do.
So thank you, guys. It sounds like we could have an entire space on this because I see a lot of energy people on here. Love my energy peeps. So we will definitely do a whole space on just this because I know we could talk about this forever, but I kind of want to hit some other points. So Lynn, what I'd like to ask you is, what is your counter argument to people saying Bitcoin's just too volatile to be considered a quote unquote stable form of money? And we have seen significant volatility that does raise questions for some people about its suitability as portfolio assets. So how do you address this issue to those people that may bring this up?
So for Bitcoin to grow from zero to $1 trillion market cap asset, it needs upward volatility. And every time there's upward volatility, there's going to be leverage built on top of it. There's going to be euphoria that comes in waves on top of it. And therefore, there's going to be downside volatility. So you can't bootstrap from zero to $1 trillion, or maybe in the future, 5 or 10 trillion or more. You can't become a new large money out of nowhere without volatility, unless, of course, it's centrally issued in some controlled way, which generally the control is through debasement over time. And so I think basically you have to separate Bitcoin into two different phases. One is the emergent phase, where it's being discovered, it's being tested to see if it's suitable, it's being tested to see if other things can do it better, it's being tested to see if the incentive structure will hold, and it has to go through that adoption cycle. And through those cycles of leverage and learning and understanding. And so I think that's the phase it's in now. I think that's a different phase in volatility than what happens when it gets closer to its total adjustable market. When most people that want Bitcoin, or that if they fully understood Bitcoin would own Bitcoin, once they get to a phase where they are at that point and Bitcoin is a larger and more distributed and more widely held asset, then we'd expect volatility to be lower, perhaps more like gold, for example, and not in the highly volatile stage that it's at now. Basically, in a highly indebted world, anything that's not the primary unit account of debt is going to have some volatility during credit cycles. And so, you know, right now the dollar is the most liquid monetary asset in the world. That's where the majority of debt is denominated. And so a lot of things are going to rotate around the dollar in terms of price action. And Bitcoin is particularly volatile because, you know, it's a global asset. It's open source. It's monetizing from zero to well over a trillion. And so it's going through that emergent process is how I would describe it.
And then what, since you brought up current debt levels, which don't seem to be going away anytime soon, you know, what is this really doing for some people that don't understand? What is this really doing to fiat, particularly USD? Because most say, well, you know, US dollar is still at 104. It's not doing anything. So can you explain kind of what the debt problem is in relation to fiat?
So partially what you see is the dollar is relatively strong against other fiat currencies, but it's down versus equities, it's down versus real estate, it's down versus gold, it's down versus Bitcoin. And so most assets that are scarcer and that are desirable in some way have been structurally appreciating against the dollar. And what makes the debt more relevant, especially public debt is what I'm referring to, because public debt and private debt have very different impacts on pricing and market structure. But basically, when there's a lot of public debt on the balance sheet, let's say over 100% debt to GDP, then as I discussed earlier in the spaces, it means that interest rate hikes are less effective at controlling inflation. Because you you know, when you raise interest rates, you do often slow down the rate of bank credit growth. But you also blow out the fiscal deficit even wider, which is a stimulus for those receiving those deficits. And if you're in a situation like the 70s, where federal debt to GDP is 30%, and most of the new money is coming from bank lending, then when you raise interest rates, the downward effect you put on bank lending is a bigger magnitude than the upward effect you put on deficits and interest expense. But if you fast forward to the current time where debt is 120% GDP, so four times higher, and you know overall bank lending is not really the source of inflation or most money creation in the current era, then when you raise interest rates, although you do put some downward pressure on that private sector money creation, the upward force you put on fiscal-driven inflation is a larger magnitude. And so the basically the issue with high public debts is that interest rates become a less effective tool and we enter fiscal dominance. It's something that has happened to developed markets back in, say, the 1940s, and it's also something we see in emerging markets on a more regular basis.
So what do you think, where do you think that we're headed for? Are we headed for stagflation or are we headed for, because it seems like we have these deflationary pressures, but we have inflationary pressures, which leads me to think it's stagflation. Or do you think it's something else?
So I think we'll go through cycles of stagflation. I think basically we're going to see higher average levels of inflation. So, you know, 2020s compared to the 2010s, basically higher highs and higher lows of inflation compared to that decade. You know, generally, this only gets resolved in the end by a fairly large currency devaluation and then some sort of pivot to, you know, kind of higher real rates and austerity. So I think basically this is going to be a pretty long and drawn out situation. It's going to be cyclical, kind of like how we're seeing inflation was very high, then there was a period of disinflation, and now we're seeing early signs of inflation reacceleration. I think it's going to be multiple cycles, multiple different narratives going around. And that's often what you see in emerging markets. You'll see many, many years of above target inflation and people arguing about why it's happening. Now, the United States is not, it has attributes that are different than an emerging market. So I think you basically see, you know, the kind of result is a developed market with some emerging market characteristics, mainly a developed market with fiscal dominance ends up having certain emerging market characteristics, namely kind of above target inflation, that interest rates aren't necessarily the tool to address them.
So where do commodities fit in this? Are we headed for a super cycle? I mean, it seems like you'd want to own hard assets in a time like this.
So I'm fairly bullish on commodities, especially the energy complex. Again, I think it'll be cyclical. I think right now the producers, they're not a crowded space structurally. So, you know, not many portfolios have overweight positions in energy producers, for example. And so, yeah, my base case is to see in the 5+ years ahead to see a fairly strong commodity and especially energy price action. Now, it's not just the U.S. that drives that. I mean, China is a very large consumer of commodities and energy in general. And so they've been in a very different dynamic. They've been in a period of tighter fiscal situation, but looser monetary situation. And so they're kind of running an opposite playbook of the United States. And so at the current time, they've been kind of putting a disinflationary force on commodities. And so I think when you analyze commodities, you have to add multiple different things together. You have to look at the United States. You have to look at China. Obviously, you have to look at some other markets as well. And so that can add complexity to the timing. But yeah, I'm structurally bullish on commodities and especially energy in that more fiscal dominant situation.
Excellent. Thank you. And so back to Marty really quickly. What are some recent trends or developments in the Bitcoin space that kind of have caught your attention and that you would like to share, and how this will impact the industry going forward?
Yeah, I think, harkening back to what we discussed in the beginning, particularly Lynn's assessment of the state of Bitcoin's health, I think it's important, maybe not important to understand, but my perspective is that there is an order of operations to Bitcoin's long-term success. Like, there's things that need to happen on the front end of that order of operations that will enable things later on in the order of operations. And so things that really excite me on the front end of the order of operations, again, the intersection of Bitcoin mining and the energy sector, developments around Bitcoin custody, particularly leveraging Bitcoin's native properties to create unique custody solutions that enable multiple parties to participate in the custody of Bitcoin, so multi-sig solutions. And then on top of that, custody solution, one thing that I'm really fascinated with, and maybe it's just recency bias because I hopped off a call about this subject and then into this space, is the integration of Bitcoin into traditional credit products. So this fiscal problem, this debt problem that exists in the world, it can be a very black pill inducing situation to come to grips with. There's a lot of debt. There's not enough dollars. It seems like the only way out is to print more money. And the conversation of whether we're going to have a soft or hard landing that is manufactured by the federal government and the central banks is the big topic of conversation. And I think Bitcoin, actually, particularly imbuing it in credit products, is a free market way to create a soft-ish landing. And so there's a bunch of companies particularly focused on commercial real estate and real estate development that are beginning to recognize that when you finance a project, if you add Bitcoin to the loan structure of that project, it really strengthens the quality of that credit product. And so one thing that I'm really interested to see whether or not it materializes in earnest this cycle is imbuing Bitcoin as collateral within credit products that really increases the profile of individual credit products. So an example would be a real estate development project that needs a $10 million loan. Instead of just taking out a $10 million USD loan, the credit provider says, all right, I'm going to give you $11 million, and I want you to buy $1 million worth of Bitcoin and hold it within the loan structure over the duration of the loan, which will be 10 to 30 years, depending on the particular project. And I think this creates a really unique situation in which you can begin to create a soft landing for a lot of these credit products, particularly in commercial and residential real estate, where by combining Bitcoin with the equity of the real estate asset, it really accelerates that and strengthens that product and makes it more robust. So if Bitcoin sits in these credit products for 10, 20, 30 years, and Bitcoin continues to monetize like it has historically over 15 years, you can envision a world in which, particularly in real estate, you have an avenue that is outside the purview of the central banks or central governments to actually manufacture a soft landing via the free market.
And Lynn, I had a question. And, you know, we've seen kind of a bifurcating world becoming more multipolar than, say, the global world, right? We've seen, you know, effectively, you know, a country like Russia that just got cut off entirely from the Western system, you know, and we could see that further. So how do you see, you know, does Bitcoin play a role in this? And how does it play a role, you know, if you're, say, you're axed out of a particular monetary system?
Well, that was its first use case, not for the sovereign level, but for the individual level. So, for example, back in, I believe it was 2011, when WikiLeaks was cut off from major payment systems and they turned to Bitcoin for donations, that was like an early example of Bitcoin being a use case for those that are cut off in one way or another. And of course, back then, it was small. It barely had any value. It was a science experiment. But now that it's 15 years older and it's, you know, over $1 trillion market cap, it, you know, it's still fairly small and volatile for the sovereign level, but it's starting to get interesting for some of the sovereigns. And so we see El Salvador obviously getting interested in it. The Kingdom of Bhutan has been mining it for quite a while. There is some mining activity in the Middle East. Reports that Russia has been turning to it. And so I do think that especially as, you know, if it continues to grow larger, more liquid, more kind of understood widely, that yes, it will turn into a useful asset for a number, basically any level that this happens on, right? So for example, the Human Rights Foundation for years now has focused on Bitcoin for those that are in authoritarian countries and cut off, right? So when people in Nigeria were protesting police violence and then their bank accounts were frozen, some of them turned to Bitcoin donations. When the trucker protest was happening in Canada and payment portals were cut off to them and bank accounts were frozen, some of them turned to Bitcoin donations. And unlike a lot of those other payment portals, something like 3/4 of the Bitcoin made it to the recipients. And only kind of the final quarter was seized. It puts more effort on the those that are going to seize the assets or prevent the assets. They have to do a lot more activity to actually do so. They can't just do it from a simple, you know, stroke of a pen. Even in Russia, the late opposition to Putin, when they were cut off from kind of their fiat rails, they turned to Bitcoin donations. So that's been a recurring theme for a while. And I do think that over time, that'll increasingly inch up to the sovereign level as well. It just has to be bigger, more mature. I think we're seeing early phases of that.
And then I just had one more question for Marty on energy before we do the final round, because we're coming up on the hour. Marty, I had a question, you know, how do you see nuclear at all fit into this picture? I mean, could SMRs be used for mining?
I think they certainly can. I mean, I'm not an expert on SMRs particularly, but I have had discussions with some companies developing SMRs. I mean, conceptually, it makes sense whether or not the SMR companies will be able to get through the regulatory red tape that exists, particularly here in the United States, is another question. But yes, conceptually, SMRs with a stated goal of bringing remote areas reliable energy and replacing diesel generation with small modular reactors does make sense. The problem they have is they can get to these areas, then they plop down the SMR, but they have to build out transmission. which takes time to build out these transmission lines and capital, obviously. And so there's probably like a 12 to 18 month lag between when you set the SMR down and when the transmission line is built out to the substation that's delivering the electricity. And Bitcoin mining could improve the economics of these projects, where you could set the SMR down and then you can mine Bitcoin behind the meter, so before it even hits the transmission line, and provide that SMR revenue before it's ready to deliver electricity to residential consumers. So conceptually, that makes a lot of sense to me, where Bitcoin can act as this buyer of first resort for these small modular reactor projects looking to bootstrap their operations and make it make sense from an economic perspective.
And there have been early cases of that with hydro in Africa, where, you know, basically if they're doing a project and they see, you know, we want to do a dam, we also have to do the transmission and all the distribution, everything, and that's going to be costly, the miner can come in and monetize the dam, and that then allows in a second phase for the other part to be built out. And so I agree with you. I think that that can apply to nuclear as well.
Yeah, I think nuclear, the bigger problem there is the regulatory red tape that exists, particularly here in the U.S.
Well, yeah, permitting for anything is a nightmare. That said, all right, we're coming up in the hour, so it's the final round. It's the same question for both of you. I'll start with Lynn. First, you can talk about something that you wanted to talk about that we didn't get a chance to, that you think it's important for our audience to hear. And or, you know, what should we be particularly focused on right now, kind of as far as an investment standpoint is, in these assets, you know, over the next 12 to 24 months?
So, I mean, from an investment standpoint, I mean, I'm bullish on gold, Bitcoin, energy producers, you know, certain stock sectors in general, including, for example, even some Latin American equities, things that are not particularly crowded at the moment. I think we're seeing a pivot, a rotation, because of this reaccelerating inflation that's breaking out, as well as, for example, we see reacceleration of PMIs, purchasing managers indices, and things like that. And so I think paying attention to that rotation's, you know, relevant in that kind of 18-month period. And, you know, if there's a big takeaway I would leave people with is to really research fiscal dominance. I touched on it multiple times. And I'm seeing, you know, I've been kind of writing about that since 2020. And it is becoming more prevalent in some academic literature, some, you know, kind of large bank investment research reports. It's kind of slowly becoming somewhat of a more consensus, less contrarian view, but I still think it's got a while to go before it's kind of fully understood, because it's so unintuitive compared to how markets worked for the past 40 years, because for most of the past 40 years, the U.S. and other developed markets were not in a state of fiscal dominance, meaning that they were not in a state where annual deficits were larger than the sum of, you know, new bank loans and new corporate bond issuance in a given year. And so now that we are, you know, we might not stay in that state every year, but now that we're more structurally in that state, markets work somewhat differently than they worked over the past 40 years. And if anything, they work more like they worked back in the 1940s in developed countries, or how they work in certain emerging markets today. And so those are useful analogs to be familiar with. But of course, applying those analogs to the 2020s in developed markets are going to be imperfect. And so I think it's going to be a challenging thing to navigate. But I think that understanding that fiscal dominance aspect is something that I think it's one of the few edges you can have in the markets this decade.
Excellent. Thank you. And Marty, kind of your final thoughts. You can talk about something we didn't get a chance to talk about, and or, you know, what is your, you know, investment view going forward, say for, you know, the next 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, I mean, I would just piggyback on what Lynn was saying about the fiscal crisis and that driving a lot of what's going on in the markets right now, and just highlight, if you look at how the Biden administration is positioning things like they're exhibiting Orwellian doublespeak, where Biden came out yesterday and said that they've lowered the deficit by $1 trillion when they're issuing $1 trillion in fresh debt every 100 days. They're trying to tell you that prices are coming down, that inflation is low when prices are higher than they've ever been, higher than they've been in generations. And so I think what I'm trying to get at here is the central planners are not coming to save you. You got to save yourself, and Bitcoin provides you a free market solution to save yourself. And I'm extremely bullish on Bitcoin. I think everything that I'm seeing is indicative of that more people are waking up to Bitcoin as the sovereign asset that can protect against the insanity of governments and central banks that are literally backed into a corner, and the only thing they can do moving forward is print more debt to try to solve the problems that they've created. And when they do step in to try to solve these problems, they're only going to make them worse. And so I think we need a free market solution to the problems that the governments and central banks have put us in. I think Bitcoin is that solution. And one thing I would leave everybody with, particularly if you're at the institutional capital level, is like, I think we've entered a period where the career risk associated with Bitcoin has flipped, where historically it's been career risk to stick your neck out and say that, hey, we should probably allocate to Bitcoin or get some exposure to Bitcoin. I think that risk has flipped now. And in 5 years, if your investors look back and you haven't allocated to Bitcoin, that is going to be an extreme career risk moving forward. The people who do not have exposure to Bitcoin are going to be laughed at in 5 to 10 years. And so if you're at the institutional capital level and you view Bitcoin as a career risk to get exposure, I would highly advise you to rethink that. I think the career risk, we're in the process of that flipping, where if you don't have exposure, people are going to demand a response to that is, how did you not get exposure to the best performing asset that the world has ever seen as it was monetizing? And so that's what I would leave everybody with.
And thank you both very much. I really appreciate it. I know our audience appreciates it. Love to have you both back on again. And we'll do just an energy one, because I've got a million DMs on this. So again, thank you both for your time today. We will definitely have you on again. And everybody else, have a great rest of your day. And I'll see you next Wednesday.
Thank you, Tracy.